people who love them.
Hello and welcome back. This is The Thing About Cars. Today is a nice summer day in Atlanta. It's kind of hot outside, but we're in an air-conditioned studio at Strongbox West as usual. And here at the table, we have
Becca
and
Ben.
And today we're going to talk about a handful of things, but I think first on the agenda, Becca has written down on the list something called a Lamborghini cell phone. What is that all about?
It was just one of those things that came across my newsfeed the other day. And they actually talk about the line attached to Lamborghini that's out there, watches, eyewear, fragrance. But I thought it was really interesting. Lamborghini is now unveiling an Android phone.
So what will the phone do that warrants the Lamborghini label?
You know, I'm looking through this, and it seems to be mostly about style.
No surprise.
It's, expensive. I haven't found the exact price yet.
Because it seems to me like, I mean, this is my first reaction. Forgive me if I'm offending anyone here, because I like Lamborghini cars. They're cool. They're slick. But they're a total exercise in ostentation, right? They're super expensive.
Yes.
And so why then would the Lamborghini company, why would they lessen themselves to put their names on something like a watch or...
Well, that's why I was snorting at the fragrance a bit. Really? I mean, unless it smells like
smell
a...
Like?
Unless it smells like a Lamborghini, what's... Why?
Right. Unless it smells like... Well, I can't say that on the air.
Does it smell like the engine? Does it smell like the interior?
Thank you. Yes. Does it smell like...
I would think the interior, because I would think if you own a Lamborghini, you probably don't know what the engine smells like. Your mechanics probably do.
Do they ever?
Right. It just doesn't sound like much fun to me if I can't ever get in there and play with it. But
no, it offers storage up to 180 gig, which iPhone did that a few years ago.
Yeah.
So, I just found the price for this starting at, and
yes,
I believe it looks like it's starting at 4 gig for the size of the phone. The starting price is $2,450.
But what on earth for? A Lamborghini branded phone? I mean, it's not going to interface with the car in any way. It's not going to do anything cool in terms of allowing me to adjust fuel air mixture while I'm going 190 miles an hour down.
And I think Ferrari did this a couple years ago, and theirs had diamonds on it.
I didn't see diamonds on this. And it looks like it's called the Alpha One. Doesn't come with a car. They actually went too far as saying that. It looks like, if you can see it, it just kind of looks leather bound.
It just looks like a normal
with
phone.
Lamborghini logos. Yeah. And if you can see that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, to our listening audience, if anyone wants to let us test drive one of these phones, please send one to us. I'm not an Android person, but I will learn just to, you know, give a review on it.
And if you have one of their cars that we can test drive, we'd enjoy that too.
In fact, we much prefer that. So,
yes, definitely.
But Lamborghini phone—that's just weird, you know—that you would put your name on something like that, and just for pure licensing purposes. What does it do to strengthen the brand? What does it do to improve your core business, which is to, you know, make kick-ass cars? I don't get it.
I think it's just another way to get money, because I'm looking through here and I'm not seeing anything that would make it stand out other than if you just loved Lamborghini that much.
Yeah.
Like if they were to put a Mustang phone out there for me kind of thing. It doesn't do anything special, but it has a name on it.
I saw a Lamborghini branded folding bicycle in Japan 10 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
It was a little, you know, folding bicycle with whatever small wheel size those folding bikes generally have. There was nothing special about it. It was silver in color, but in big black lettering in the Lamborghini script you see on all their products, right on the main frame tube.
So it was an officially licensed thing?
As far as I could tell, yeah.
Remember the Ferrari glasses that came out in the 80s?
Oh, yeah.
You know, they folded up in the middle?
Yes.
Right.
And, I wonder if those were officially licensed things.
Probably.
Looking ahead of the agenda, I want to skip around a bit because we had written down Mickey stops to help. And the thing I had in mind when I said that was I do actually stop to help folks on the side of the road if the conditions are favorable, if I can get over safely and help folks out. And it's always simple stuff, changing a tire, jumping a battery, whatever. But this weird thing has been going on where, like, in the last month and a half, I've helped 4 people jump a battery in a parking lot.
Wow.
Every single one of them had cables.
Hmm.
Right? So they didn't need cables, but none of them were able to successfully jump their battery. And I whip out my super heavy duty gauge cables that I've got, that I've had since the late 80s. Just thick wiring is all it is, and we can jump no problem.
Hmm.
Those things do the trick without even blinking, in the way that those emergency tiny gauge cables just apparently can't handle the job.
Well, if you gave them more time, they would.
Right.
Or charge to accumulate across.
Exactly, if you could do that. But it's like, okay, who not many people know that either, right?
Right.
Not many people that you can,
That's what I was going to say. There's actually a lot of people out there that don't know the proper steps to take during jumping a car. So if you're going to stop and help somebody, control the cables yourself so they don't run the risk of causing damage.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, you're supposed to let it sit for a moment before you try starting up the other car.
Right.
You've got to let it feed for a minute.
You got to give it a charge, especially on the smaller gauge wires. It's something that I think most people don't know. So I've been telling folks out loud, just get heavier gauge cables because most people don't want to wait, right?
Right.
And if you don't want to wait, just get the heavier gauge cable and save yourself the headache and just put them in the trunk where you keep your spare tire.
I don't want to say rule of thumb. I really hate that one. We need to come up with something better. That to jump off a, say, six-cylinder, you needed a six-cylinder or above that was working. Or if you're jumping off an eight-cylinder, you had to have another eight-cylinder
to jump
off.
That's a new one on me.
You've never heard that?
Never. Heard that.
They've been saying, okay, that doesn't really apply anymore. But I found it still really helps as far as the ability to jump a car. Inability if you've got the V8 that needs to be jumped.
Right.
It's just something behind it.
But it shouldn't because they've all got more or less the same batteries and alternators, regardless of the cylinders.
Unless there's a major variance in amperage or something.
But the draw from the car being jumped... potentially, the cold cranking amps, potentially, I don't know.
Well, no, because the starter motor may have more work to do with a larger engine, but the car providing the jump is not going to have any effect on that because electrons moving in wires don't know how many cylinders are there.
I don't know. It's just one of those that I had always been taught when I was growing up, and it seemed to always play out. So I've just stuck to it.
So we're going to, I guess we should ask our listeners then if they know if the axiom holds true, then you need a bigger engine or a same-sized engine to jump.
You need a bigger alternator.
Bigger alternator.
That's really it. Honestly, a bigger battery. The alternator's not even doing the work.
Well, I've jumped. When I drove the Honda, I've jumped other cars off that tiny little four-banger
wasn't
in. So I know it's possible, but, is it a question of time, or is it like Becca is saying, do you need the bigger engine to jump a smaller engine?
And there's some small and light new-tech batteries out now. That there's one this big, and of course, nobody hearing can see this, but like a 3x6-inch little motorcycle battery somebody's making that...
Is it bigger than a bread box? Maybe we should use that. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's about a quarter the size of a standard car battery. And when one magazine tested, they jumped a Dodge Cummins turbo diesel truck off it 22 times before it discharged.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, it's not needing a larger car to jump a smaller car.
Right.
It's just needing the equivalent of the dead car or greater.
Right.
So if you're jumping a V6, they're saying don't use a four-cylinder.
Right.
No, complete baloney.
It's played out in my life. I don't know. It could be me.
So, listeners, please weigh in on this. Please visit our Facebook page and tell us if this thing is true in your experience or not. Because I think Ben and I are going to rest on the side of no, and any engine can jump any other engine.
It's not the engine you're jumping, it's the electrical system.
Right,
and I don't have any reasonable argument. It was just something, like I said, that was always told to me, and any time I've tried to go against it, I've discovered I've had problems. I have no logical argument
for it. It's good conversation fodder. Let's,
See what absolutely. Like, so. Absolutely.
What else is on our list?
Well, Mazda weirdness.
Mazda weirdness, yes. So the Mazda, my Mazda in particular, does this weird thing where every once in a while, I'll crank it, and it acts like the battery's not there.
Not there or dead?
Not there. And so I'll get out, and I'll jiggle the positive cable, and the thing just acts normal all over again. But I'll get out, and I'll jiggle the cable, and then the thing starts normally all over again. Of course, at that point, I have to reset all my clocks and the calendars in the car.
So could it be, I'm going to forget the technical term for your connections to the battery. Is it time for new connections?
It could be a time for new terminals, I guess. I'm not sure. But they're tightened down hard. I mean, I tighten them myself. So I know they're not loose on the terminal.
Could it be the wire connecting to the actual loop that goes around the
battery terminal? That's possible.
It is a possibility.
Because a lot of them are exposed right where the... I'm having trouble.
And your battery terminals are good and clean, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So that's, it might be the wire to the battery terminal.
Specifically the positive terminal. The ground is fine.
Check the other end of it as well.
Yeah.
Or the bolt that tightens it. I know you said it is tight, but if it's wiggling and may making that tightness come and go.
Yep.
Possibly.
Well, and it's one. I'm wondering if this problem occurs when I'm actually driving, and for a while it's just
the vibrations and the road bumps and
exactly. So there's an electrical issue that comes up on the OBD. The next time we get together to record, I'll have the number with us.
That was not his Mazda starting, by the way.
Yeah, that wasn't.
What was that?
We're not in a soundproof room, though. I wish we were. Strongbox West is definitely trafficked on Saturdays. So today being a Saturday, there's stuff happening around the building.
It sounds like a contact issue somewhere on that cable. Yeah.
I wonder what's on the other end of the terminal down below. It's like underneath the battery. Is there something going on?
Probably goes down to. Well, I know on older cars, it goes down to a starter solenoid.
Exactly.
So you may have a bad connection there.
That is a possibility, but I've been, as far as I could reach from the top side of the engine, I have checked everything I could check.
Yeah. Cable itself could even be defective.
The cable could be defective. But it happens not predictably, but it happens regularly.
Yeah.
Like maybe once a month, once every 6 weeks or something like that. And I have to, get out. Just all I have to do is jiggle the wire just a little bit, and the car starts up normally.
Plus, with Georgia temperatures, something to keep in mind, the heat expanding and contracting of metals.
But it's inside the engine, which gets super hot anyway. So,
but that's when you're having the problem, though. So the car hasn't been running. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm just kind of walking through it. If you're trying to start it up when it's 90 degrees versus, 8 a.m. when it's 79 degrees.
Right.
I don't know.
But no, I wish I had that kind of predictability, too, but I don't. But on the topic of Mazdas, we had a few other things we wanted to talk about in terms of Mazdas. Ben, what did you have?
One of the things is there's some press that Mazda's getting right now. They've got another engine design coming out. It'll be for 2019. It's basically compression ignition. It's going to be a gasoline engine that part of the time works like a diesel. It's actually going to use compression force to ignite the fuel charge. Now, not all the time. They're saying in their press that it will have an ignition system that will do the job some of the time, probably when the engine's not under a great amount of load. But this is going to be the next generation Skyactiv engine. They're going to be calling it Skyactiv X, whereas the ones they're making now are the G generation.
Let's back up for a second. What does regular old Skyactiv do?
Well, it's a combination of design features in not only the engine, but also the entire car that the engine is put into that are all optimized for fuel efficiency.
Hmm.
In fact, in the current Skyactiv G generation, they go so far as to use an alternator that, when it doesn't need to charge, actually disengages itself for less resistance, so that's putting less drag on the engine. They do all other things too, like lighter weight suspension components. They think of the whole Skyactiv car as a system, as opposed to just an engine option. I have a Skyactiv. I'm not sure if it's G. It's a 2013. It's the one right before G. I don't know if they even gave it a letter generation, but yeah, it's really efficient and it's still fun to drive. In the current G generation, they offer a 180 horse version with a 6-speed manual. I've test driven one and it gets awesome miles per gallon and it's still pretty fun. So this X version is going to be even more efficient, and fun to drive is kind of Mazda's core philosophy. So, I would not expect it to be, a dull car.
Well, this Mazda, this older Mazda that I've got, is definitely fun to drive.
Yeah.
But I've met one guy who has a criticism. He says that the new Mazda 6s that are coming out are underpowered. And they don't have the pep that the older Mazda 6s, especially the sport versions, used to have.
Right.
So I don't know. Having not driven any of the new ones, I don't know how to weigh in on that. I didn't know if you'd heard anything.
I haven't, and I haven't driven it. But, it's entirely possible, because every car company, no matter how tightly they try to stick to their philosophy, they may not always get it right. We all know instances in the past where some companies missed their marks.
Right, right.
Ben, I think you need to go test drive one and let us know.
Probably, yeah.
Let's do it. Let's all go test drive.
Well, you guys know what Mazdas feel like and have an idea of whether it does have more pep or less pep.
Right.
I don't think I've ever actually driven a Mazda.
Well, and the other,
I was quite surprised. I got to say, here's a shameless plug for Mazda in this regard, or at least an impromptu rave review for Mazda, is that prior to owning this Mazda, I had never considered that I would ever buy a Mazda ever. My family grew up on, I learned to drive on a Chevy. I watched my dad drive around for many years before that on a Dodge Dart.
Wait, the old one or?
No, the newer Dodge Dart. It was totally a little grandma Dodge Dart. It was all but yeah, not the new one. No. And so I drove on a Chevy. Our first cars were all Hondas when Hondas in the 80s were all, you know, hitting the market really big. And then not until the late 90s did my family ever look towards any of the other car companies ever, right? It was like nothing but Honda for the longest time. And then when the first Chrysler Voyager came out, the Dodge Caravan Chrysler Voyager, Dad was really impressed with what a minivan was. And so he bought one of those. And that was the first departure from Honda that we had ever made. And then later on, he was like, wow, Volvo has this great safety rating. Let's get a Volvo. So he drove the Volvo for the longest time. And then I inherited that car and drove it. But nowhere on our radar as a family for years had been Mazda until my friend Erica sold me this particular Mazda. And I'm like, wow, this is really a cool car.
They're kind of, I don't want to say underdog, but they're a smaller player in the U.S. market. They don't have the numbers some of the others do. They don't hype themselves as much either.
Right.
They're a little quieter, a little more unassuming, but good grief, they make a great car.
Well, there's more out there than you know of, too, because an awful lot of the Fords now have Mazda engines. So and vice versa. There are some Mazdas out there with Ford engines.
Not as much now. Not new ones, because they're no longer in partnership with Ford. They're in partnership with Toyota right now.
Mazda and Toyota?
Yeah. Which is interesting, too, because the fact that they're still doing great technology with gasoline engines while Toyota is leaning so hard on electrics, which is not to say Mazda is not, you know, paying attention. They actually are pursuing some electric, you know, things in other markets, but not so much in the United States.
Well, that reminds me, going back to what we talked about a minute ago, with the new battery technology, I'm wondering what that's going to do to change the way electrics get produced.
So
I would very much like to see that, because the battery is the one thing that continues to hold up real advances in electric transportation.
And on top of that, just, you know, infrastructure for supporting charging.
Right.
You know, there's so few chargers around and the amount of time it takes.
Well, I mean, the two influence each other, right? I mean, the infrastructure, the shape of the infrastructure will change based upon the need of the batteries that rely on it.
Yeah.
So,
but even now, there just aren't that many places you can charge.
So when are we going to go do the Mazda test drive?
I say, if you want to drive either of ours, we can do this after we're done here today. But
let's make a date and do this. Let's go invade a Mazda dealership one day and tell them what we're up to and see if they'd like to play with us for a little while.
Right, yeah. So. You know that current generation Miata is the first one I can comfortably get my knees under the steering wheel.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But they're not selling well.
I'm kind of surprised, because it looks like a cool car. Isn't the MX-5 is what it's called? The MX-5/Miata?
I saw one in passing, but we were both moving, so I didn't get to really have a good look at it.
Yeah. I saw one yesterday, and I know a guy in South Carolina who bought the retractable hardtop special version they've got out now that I haven't seen in person yet.
I don't know. I rode around in a friend's that was the original, what I called the Jelly Bean Miata. And I understand the appeal. It was little. It was quick, but when riding in it, I couldn't help but feel like just traffic fodder. I was waiting to be run over by some other car. I felt so tiny and so vulnerable in this car. I mean, I tend to drive bigger cars, though, so maybe it was just my perception.
Yeah, but it's a different experience.
I felt so tiny in that car.
I remember
they are tiny.
I remember Road and Track when the first generation Miata came out. Someone dropped a 5-liter Mustang engine in.
Yes, they were called the Killer Go Karts.
Yeah, and I just laughed out loud. Well, there's the cover of Road and Track back in those days.
There's a company that's all about doing that. Yeah. Well, I don't know which engines they lean toward, but there's a company called Flying Miata, and they have all the bits you need if you want to put a V8 in one of those. It's more than just an engine bell housing adapter. It's suspension, it's brakes, it's frame stiffening.
Oh, yeah, you have to do
it. It's everything.
That.
It's a total package. They can sell you all the bits. I've seen a few of them. They frequently do a little gathering at the MIDI weekend at Road Atlanta whenever that comes around.
Huh.
What is that, Flying Miata, you said?
I think it's Flying with an apostrophe, but yeah.
That is so funny. I didn't know that people were still making killer go-karts.
And before that, there were the guys who were putting V8s and MGs.
Right.
You know, it's nothing new.
Oh, yeah. I actually
it's a lot of fun.
Had written down one time and never really got to it, questioning if somebody had tried to do a V8 in something like a Mini Cooper. one of the newer ones, not one of the original ones.
I don't know, but the original ones are smaller, and I have seen
one of the... That's why not the originals, but maybe the newer ones.
But I have seen one of the original ones outfitted with a VTEC Honda engine.
Now, that's interesting.
And I'll bet it was a Screamer.
I would not be surprised at all. But, I mean, have you seen inside the engine compartment of the newer Mini? There's not a lot of room in there.
I would think that there wouldn't be... Yeah. I like the styling of the new Mini Cooper, but short from that, everything, the interior, the gauge cluster, everything is a lot to me. I would rip it out. So it would need to be a shell, basically, that I got my hands on, which was when I started thinking about, all right, well, what else can we get in here? But no, I hadn't looked under the hood of one, so I wasn't sure how much room it had.
Well, the last time I looked in the hood of a Mini, there was nothing special about it, just standard Mini, and there was not enough space for me to get my hand between the radiator and the engine block.
Okay, so if I register in Bartow County where there's no emissions and my parents live, and I rip everything out and don't need all that computer stuff, and I can put an old big block in there, or small block would probably work better.
Yeah, I bet you're still going to have to cut firewall, cut other stuff. You're gonna end up.
We could probably do some shaving. I don't know. I need to look under the hood, see if there's room for shaving.
What you could do, take out the back seats, gut the whole rear end of the thing.
But then I wouldn't have anywhere to put my kids. See, I have to have room to put them
in a car like this, it will not matter. Actually, you'll be able to stick them up in the front compartment that the engine will no longer be inhabiting.
Exactly.
So what you do is you rip out everything in the back end. You find a fairly compact V8, mate that to, say, a Porsche G50 six-speed transaxle. You'll have a longitudinal mid-engine, and the size of the Mini has enough body room that'll fit right behind the seats and right in front of your rear wheels.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Oh, yes. Okay. You can do this.
Do not try this at home.
I also saw a car at the Georgia Tech Auto Show where someone had taken a Subaru Flat 6 with the transmission. Remember, this is a longitudinal engine transmission. They had just simply not used the rear drive. They used the outputs to the front wheels of the Subaru, put this in the back end of a first-generation Honda Insight, which, of course, had all its electrics and batteries and everything gone. And the whole front end of the car was mostly missing.
That's hilarious.
This is one of those build a race car for no money projects that the tech students do.
Sure.
It looked like, you know, something out of a Mad Max movie, but...
We need to talk to them. We need to talk to those tech students.
We really do.
But anyway, one more thing on our... We got about 5 minutes left. With this particular episode, and there's one more thing on the agenda.
Which one was that? The headlights. Now, one of y'all started it, and I chimed in with all my opinions. We had been talking about halogen headlights.
Yes.
And one of y'all had brought it up.
Yeah, this morning I was replacing a headlight bulb on my significant other's car. This is a 2007 Mazda 3. Here we go with the Mazdas again. But it's not a Mazda issue, though.
Welcome to the Mazda show.
Yeah, I've had this complaint with a lot of vehicles, anything using an H7 bulb in particular, that they always make them very difficult to change. I mean, easy in theory, difficult in execution.
Sure.
They're located in such a place where you need hands about the size that a 6-year-old would have to get to it.
No, my 7-year-olds apparently have smaller or bigger hands than mine. So even it's impossible to get into. I think it was the same setup on the Lexus I was working on.
My Mark IV VW had, the battery was right behind the headlight assembly on the left. And
you
there
have
was
to remove the battery and the bracket and all that first.
Pretty much, because there was just enough room to get the cover off the back of the light before you hit the battery. Right side, not so bad. On this Mazda this morning, it was the easier one to get to, but it still caused me a lot of consternation. I was down there with a light and a mechanics inspection mirror trying to figure out how that clip reengages when the new bulb goes in. And
that was one of the things that I was talking about, was that clip, trying to get it back.
Right.
You can't see what you're doing. And like you, I had lights and things going every which way. We actually did have to remove the battery from the Lexus to get in there. But it wasn't even the room issue. It was just how it was set up. Mm-hmm. Instead of the old halogen, you put it in there, you turn it a quarter turn one direction, and it locks in place. These have this metal
Yep.
Wire thing that clips into place, so, but it's got to go up and around.
To their credit, I will say that the retainers on this clip are all made of metal, unlike a BMW motorcycle I have, which also uses an H7. And you would think that it would be easier to do because there's not as much body work, but you do have to kind of reach down in there between the oil cooler and the instrument panel, and you can see it from sitting, you know, with your hands on the bars. You can see the back of the headlight, but that doesn't mean it's easy to reach.
Right.
There's a little cover you screw off, and there's a wire inside there. There's another one of these little retaining clips. And the problem with this one is not so much the manipulating the clip as much as what retains it is a screw with two little plastic tabs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those tabs invariably break,
yep. Yes.
Which means the clip won't stay in place. The fix for this is to put a bigger washer under the screw.
Oh, I see.
But,
so here's my, it's not quite a fix, but
right.
Whenever I've had to do this, I have learned to rehearse something for muscle memory. For the sake of muscle memory.
I see. For the so Lexus, I don't have muscle memory car.
Not even that. Like, every single time I have to relearn this, and I know perfectly well once I look at the bulb from the back end what I have to do. And so without even looking, I'll close my eyes, and I'll remember how, I'll get a feel for it, and I'll remember how that wire clips into that metal clip.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll unclip it and reclip it without moving anything else about 5 times before I actually unclip it and remove the bulb.
That's a good idea.
And then, so I could get used to the way that works, and I'm keeping track of where that wire swings out of the way. So the bulb comes out, the new bulb goes in, and then I put it all back together again. So,
see, I was going to go in a totally different direction. I have an inspection scope camera that I was just going to get out. It has to attach to a laptop, though. So next time I'm going to go through the trouble of setting up that scope. So
I was just using the good old inspection mirror, like a bigger version of what the dentist has. Right. You know,
I
could see it, but I couldn't. It just didn't want to engage. And so, you know, based on all that, as I was doing all this, I was thinking to myself, yeah, bring on the LED headlights. You know, because
I think that the larger picture that we're not talking about here is that a lot of these things are no longer supposed to be user serviceable things. User serviceable things.
Yeah, that's the direction that they're going, is to make it so that shade trees can't work.
And I hate that.
I don't think that's intentional, though.
You don't think so?
No. I think it's the result of trying too hard on production efficiency.
Huh.
Make it all as an assembly, slap it together at the factory, and get it out the door.
I have a friend who's a mechanic that would argue with you on that. He definitely feels that it's going towards not allowing people to work on it, and even more so to not allowing non-dealerships to have difficulty with proprietary software and equipment.
Well, software is one thing, but physical access is something that the dealer mechanic and the shade tree mechanic equally have to deal with.
Well, and I know we're running out of time.
They've got the same equipment.
Yeah.
They've got the same lift and the same toolbox.
Yeah.
they don't always have the same toolboxes.
Let me get to this.
Part of the reason why it ended up saying this on the list, because you'd also mentioned I should hold on to the problems with changing the headlights in the G8, which are not, they're not HID. I believe they're just projector. But you do have to remove the front bumper, some front end bracing, and all this other. Now, some people will say if you go in through the bottom, turn the wheel, remove the fender skirting, up this way, which is how I've changed the fog lights. I'm not so sure I can even reach up to the headlights at that point. So, the way that it's going, my Mustang, I reach down, grab a hold of it, turn it 1/4, pull it out, stick a new bulb in, reach down, turn it 1/4 the other way. And that's that, and I miss that.
All right, that is all we have time for today. So thanks once again for joining us with the Thing About Cars, recording as always from the most excellent Strongbox West facility. Please do check them out and tell them we said hello and that we love them. You can always find us, as usual, on our website, thethingaboutcars.com, or on Facebook. We have a page that's simply called The Thing About Cars. And do send us your suggestions. And if you have any questions, send us those. We're always looking for those. We're I think, before the end of the year, going to start doing Skype calls for listeners if we can get folks to line those up with us. So please do that. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and we look forward to seeing you guys again soon. Thank you.
Bye.
All right.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.